Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Tired by a relentless hobnobbing with the rich and famous out here.
Really? Who you been talking to?
I don't want to say. I don't want to drop names.
No, go ahead. Come on.
No.
Mickey.
Let's just say that if you talk to a girl at a party out here and she looks sort of like Demi Moore, but not quite Demi Moore.
It could actually be her?
It is often actually Demi Moore.
Huh.
Which I didn't know until after I talked to her.
You know, she likes younger men. Are you younger than her?
Her husband was there.
Oh. He's younger, right?
Yeah.
Huh. What did she say? Did she mention blogging heads? What are her views on me?
She didn't mention blogging heads.
Really?
She said her whole family had a cold and she was very polite and considerate and didn't say a whole lot. So.
Wow. Well, I didn't meet anybody that important.
There you go. Oh, surely you did. But anyway.
No. Not in the last few days, I don't think.
Well, cool. So there. So I dropped the name. I feel dirty already.
You really should. I'm ashamed of you. But I think more highly of you than ever before.
It's
the way these things work.
That wasn't hard. Okay. Anyway. Are you ready to surge?
Well, I guess Bush is ready to surge. I mean, shortly, when's he going to give his surge talk?
He's going to give his surge talk characteristically after we tape this, but before it airs.
The news has a way of doing that to us, doesn't
it? So everything we say now is going to be completely obsolete.
Well, I don't think the speech is going to hold huge surprises, right? He's going to say he's going to surge.
It's interesting. Reading up on this and watching the video of Kagan and Keene, who are the two architects of what we think is the administration strategy for a surge,
mm-hmm.
There's a very good video of them giving a talk at AEI, and it's useful because they make it clear that they have no intention of going after Sadr, that their plan does not involve invading Sadr City. You leave Sadr City alone. You concentrate on the Sunni and mixed neighborhoods, and you somehow, because you are protecting the Shiites against the Sunnis, then that gives Maliki some argument to go to Sadr and say, okay, the Americans are doing your work for you. Now you can disarm.
But meanwhile, you've had to more or less side with the Shiites in a civil war against the Sunnis to get to this point, right?
Right. So that runs the risk of alienating the Sunnis. Plus, if you read what Dan Bartlett says in the New York Times today, and what Maliki seems to be saying, the Sadr City is not off limits. Where in fact, you know, Bartlett said we conditioned the surge on Maliki is letting us go into Sadr City. Now, that could just be for show, but it seems to me the big question hanging over this surge is, are we going to go after Sadr or not? It seems sort of futile to go after Sadr, yet if we don't go after Sadr, as you say, that just gives the Sunnis a better argument to continue the insurgency.
Yeah, and mega-surge advocate John McCain has been arguing for going after Sadr for some time, I know.
Right, so there's a split between McCain and Keene and Kagan on that. Petraeus seems to, in the Michael Gordon piece, seems to...
This is General Petraeus who's taking over now the whole operation in Iraq.
Right. Who favors the surge seems to side with Keene and Kagan and have bought into the... let the Shiites know they don't need these evil militias.
Yeah, there's an irony here, which is kind of the left is now kind of dissing the surge as the least enlightened thing we could do, and I don't think it's going to be productive myself, but Petraeus, the champion of it, actually was one of the more enlightened people in principle, I think. And one of the less militaristic people in the military. I mean, he was aware from the beginning of the sensitivity of conducting counterinsurgency warfare, and I think part of the argument for more troops is that to be sensitive, you have to have the strength, right? In other words, to apply force in a deft manner, you have to have plenty of it available. My own view is that at this point, it's deeply problematic
we're certainly not going to have plenty. The rationale seems to be that this as they stand up, we will stand down strategy, which we've been pursuing for a couple of years, was a mistake because the people who stood up for them were these sectarian militias.
Yeah, and a mistake they're now blaming on the last general, whereas, of course, the fact is the only reason that particular general rose to the top of the Bush hierarchy is because he happened to agree with what had been determined by the Bush administration, I would argue on political grounds largely, to be the optimal thing to think, which is that, yes, we can win this war without sending more troops over.
I wonder how long it'll be before they blame the stand-up, stand-down strategy on the left. In other words, it's only because there was all this drumbeat of, oh, we're getting too many soldiers killed over there, that we went to this sort of Vietnamization-style policy, which seems to lower American casualties or held out the prospect of it, that turned out to be such a disaster. But, of course, if Bill Kristol had had his way, we never would have done that. And he did attack it at the time.
Well, yeah, fine. But Bush, I mean, who's going to be making this excuse? Bush can't make it. He has said too many times, too forcefully, they'll stand up as we stand down.
I guess that's right.
I mean, for him to blame the left would be like what they accuse the left of doing, which is always finding some excuse for their own pathological behaviors.
And the other component of this, of course, that's undiscussed is do we go after Iran? Is that part of it somehow?
Let me briefly say on the surge that the piece in the New York Times today about us and the Iraqi forces going after this Sunni stronghold in Baghdad drove home to my mind what a nearly hopeless situation this is.
Why?
Did you read this piece?
No,
big, I didn't. A big battle right near the Green Zone.
I know there was a big battle.
It's funny because, my generic reaction to Surge had been that the irony is that we're just getting to the point where more and more people are agreeing that, look, in the long run, we got to settle for some kind of partition, either separate sectarian states or highly autonomous regions. And, you know, given how much ethnic cleansing has been done already to pave the way for that demographically, right, to create these homogeneous blocks of landscape, maybe that's the thing to go with. And now the whole idea of Surge is to stop that process, right? But before Baghdad becomes really coherent demographically, to stand in and stop it, that seemed an irony to me. Then I read this piece that, in the Times it says, Shiites are clearly a Senate throughout Baghdad. This is in this piece today, systematically taking over Sunni neighborhoods. And then the area around Haifa Street, where this big battle was, had remained a Sunni bastion, and that's where we're taking the Sunnis on. And I thought, maybe the surge, maybe we're going to devote our forces to actually, you know, kind of hastening the demographic transition, you might say. But again, if we do that, I don't think that's the conscious plan. And besides, if we do that, then we are just clearly taking sides in a civil war. So I don't know. There was this David Brooks column kind of trying to have it both ways. Did you read this?
No, he adopted the solution that I had toyed with a couple weeks ago, and that Andrew Sullivan had actually mentioned a couple months ago, which is instead of using what you just talked about, instead of using the surge to stop the de facto partition of Iraq, use the surge to aid the de facto partition.
But not in this way. He wasn't. That's the thing. He wasn't upfront enough to say if you're really going to go with the flow here, you basically have to facilitate ethnic cleansing. He had some very kind of euphemistic line about, we'll escort people to their homelands. Well, if you can do it in that peaceful a fashion, fine. But I think to do it that way, you've got to establish order first. And establishing order seems to entail the kinds of attacks of which this was one. I mean, it's just not going to be as simple, as he made it out to be.
This attack wasn't aiding ethnic cleansing in a mixed neighborhood. This was an attack on a Sunni stronghold.
Right, so, but Mickey, this had become the kind of Sunni enclave the source of the resistance to further Shiite ethnic cleansing. The Shiites were cleaning the landscape of Sunnis, and the Sunnis were backed up into this one corner. And yes, you can call them insurgents. They had guns. When it's a civil war, you have guns. When you're trying to fight ethnic cleansing, you have guns, okay? So this was the Sunnis, you know, one of the last stands against ethnic cleansing. You know, and our troops are stepping in and saying, sorry, you know, you're going to have to do this without guns. Well, if you don't have guns, you are going to get ethnically cleansed.
I do not think this was an attack on Sunnis who were resisting ethnic cleansing. I think this was an attack on Sunni insurgents who were setting up car bombs in Shiite neighborhoods. And we're just really, you know, people
right,
who are opposed
but
to
Mickey,
the government.
But, Mickey, in this kind of situation, the only defense is a good offense. I mean, this is the way you resist ethnic cleansing in a situation like this. I mean, you put the other team on the defensive. You try to cleanse their neighborhoods. It's basically a civil war.
I don't think Sunnis are cleansing Shiites in Baghdad. They're cleansing Shiites elsewhere in the country. I don't think... why does that make sense? Why is...
Well, let me just say, I think that what the Sunnis in this bastion of Sunni militancy were doing that we attacked was trying to not entirely lose the ethnic cleansing war in Baghdad. Do you agree with that?
No, I think they're trying to foment a civil war in Baghdad. And I don't
no,
think that,
no,
I don't
these
think
were these were Baathists, Mickey. These are not like crazy Al Qaeda guys who just think the more blood, the better. These are Baathists, I think. These are relatively well. Actually, it's hard to say. It's a former Baathist neighborhood.
I don't think these people were doing anything that was going to result in fewer Sunnis being cleansed in mixed neighborhoods. I think they were fomenting a war,
fomenting a war is what both sides are doing, Mickey. Why are you only calling it that when Sunnis do it?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's not like that these people were peacefully resisting attacks on their community that we were going after.
No, they're not peacefully. It's beyond the point where you can resist it peacefully. They're resisting ethnic cleansing the only way you can do it, which is with a good offense.
They could resist it peacefully. They could say, you know,
They could sit down and like immolate themselves or something.
No,
go on hunger strikes.
No, if you read Iraq the Model, I'm sorry, I read it again. I apologize, but you know, their neighborhoods, they have local militias and they band together and they keep people out. They defend themselves. That's different than setting up car bombs in your neighbors.
Well, the defending your Mickey,
I don't see
Mickey
where that helps protect you to set up a car.
Mickey,
bomb.
The defending yourself approach had manifestly not been working. The Sunni neighborhoods were dropping one by one.
Well, but I don't see where the existence of these insurgents on Haifa Street in the Sunni neighborhood was preventing that at all. It was just inflaming it and encouraging it.
Well, both sides are inflaming the situation. That's what I'm saying, Mickey. Both sides are inflaming the situation. It's a civil war. At this point, we step in, and everything we do is just helping one side of the civil war. And if you do that symmetrically, you probably just wind up prolonging the civil war.
I don't know. I understand that point. I just didn't understand your point about the attacks on Haifa Street. I guess the ultimate question is, are you for the surge or against it? And you know, I think it's probably doomed for the reasons that everybody says that we hold these neighborhoods for 18 months, and then what happens when we leave? Is there any chance that a neutral Iraqi force will take over? Is there any chance that the Mahdi army will be disarmed by then? Probably not. But if we have a smart guy like Petraeus who thinks it can work, let him have a shot. I mean, you know, my soldier friend who went to Iraq says this is stupid. It's just going to get 200 of my buddies killed for no good reason. And that's sort of the soldier's perspective. But don't we sort of owe it to the Iraqis to at least try after causing this?
Do something that's futile anyway. I mean, my view is any policy that doesn't acknowledge that at this point partition is the thing to shoot for, you know, is probably not worth pursuing. And as I understand the surge policy, that's not the idea.
Yeah.
The idea is that we can maintain Iraq as a unified, internally harmonious polity. You know, that just seems to me so naive. I'm not going to accept, I'm not willing to see people, us or Iraqis, more of them die for that policy.
You would hope that under the guise of a surge to protect, that we would actually be doing things to encourage the separation of the sects. I agree. And that would be the smart thing to do. And it's hard to believe that, you know, Petraeus isn't going to do that, but that's the sort of wishful thinking that got us into this war. So,
I don't know.
It's a sort of wishful thinking that the human brain tends to gravitate toward.
What are you segueing to?
It's a possible segue to this.
The psychology of war thing?
It's possible.
Yeah. Daniel Kahneman, this Nobel laureate social scientist and a colleague, wrote this piece for Foreign Policy, just arguing that human nature kind of favors hawkishness on balance. There are these various kinds of biases of judgment that are built into human nature, like we tend to be overconfident under certain circumstances, overestimate the control we have over certain situations. They were arguing that on balance, these favor hawkishness. Did you have a chance to read it? It wasn't very long.
I read it, and I certainly had that had manifested all the, even though I wasn't a supporter of the war, I manifested all those pathologies going into the war. When people said, well, we don't have enough troops and the occupation will be difficult, I sort of said, oh, well, you know, things move much faster, so countries are gravitating toward democracy much more quickly than before, and look at Afghanistan, and, all these ancient rivalries will drop away faster than we ever thought. I sort of reassured myself that everything was going to be okay in a sort of very biased way. What I didn't understand was why is this hawkish mindset evolutionary advantageous? Why would millennia of evolution have bred this into our brains? And how does this differ from what I remember from your book, which is the tendency of people to always think that they are the victim and they are right in arguments? That applies to marital spats, personal relationships. You always distort reality so that, you know, the other side is the aggressor and you're making concessions. Does that make any sense at all?
Well, first of all, they didn't cast the argument in explicitly evolutionary terms, although I know that Kahneman is somewhat sympathetic to these kinds of...
Well, right, but you're an evolutionary psychologist, so if our mind has some quality, it must come from evolution, so...
Yeah,
so
well, first of all, it's a little more, I mean, the landscape of the data, I think, is a little more complex than they had time to illuminate. For example, we tend to, in terms of our control over situations, we tend to see ourselves as having had a lot of control over things that went well and a lot of responsibility for them and not so much over things that went badly. They may actually mention that, I don't know. And part of that, it seems to be kind of a public relations thing. It allows you to go around believing your stories when you tell stories that tend to inflate your own stature.
Right.
And your narratives are self-serving in that way. I mean, the thing you just mentioned, I think, the idea that we're in the right when, in fact, from, you know, kind of God's perspective, it's actually a little more ambiguous than that. Well, that you would think, I mean, and this is just a somewhat conjectural story, but you would certainly think that that helps people argue for their interests with conviction. And during evolution in a hunter-gatherer society, these arguments really matter. You know, you're having arguments about who deserves what. Some of the resources you're arguing about do have bearing on who will get their genes into the next generation and who wins the arguments and who amasses support among your neighbors for your argument really matters. So it's important that you argue with conviction and you be able to say, wait a second, I'm in the right, and this person is in the wrong. So to some extent, you know, to demonize them. And one thing I haven't had time to think through, I didn't have as much time as I hoped to think about this, is how exactly, I mean, if it's true that these psychological elements together have the net effect of getting us into more counterproductive wars than productive wars, right? In other words, they work to our disadvantage.
Right.
Then, you know, you would think that it's the case that they're kind of not working as designed in a certain sense. In other words, I put designed in quotes because we're talking about natural selection designing something.
You just put it much, you've hit on the point that I was groping incoherently toward.
Well, the standard kinds of explanations when things that were thought to be adaptations, that is to say, you know, kind of designed in quotes products of natural selection, when psychological adaptations don't work to your advantage or the advantage of your kin, in other words, they wouldn't have gotten your genes into the next generation in the ancestral environment, the kind of explanation you grope for is that the environment has changed so much that as these impulses are applied in the modern environment, they naturally misfire. I mean, the classic example is, road rage, right? There's a reason that when somebody cuts us off, you know, does something to us, whether it steals something or something, we're filled with rage and want to retaliate. It's not that mysterious why that would have been a productive impulse in the environment of our evolution. But when you're on a highway, there's no money at all in pursuing it. I mean, A, the person that you want to teach the lesson to is somebody you'll never see again. Nobody in your family will ever see them. There's actually no benefit at all in teaching them the lesson. And B, there's risk associated with teaching it to them. So,
but in the environment of evolution, you're in a hunter-gatherer party, and you come across a neighboring clan. War, in that case, as Matt Iglesias points out, is likely to be a negative-sum proposition. If you get in a fight, somebody's going to get hurt and killed, and you might lose. And you would think evolution would equip us with the faculties designed to have us avoid unnecessary wars, since it's, you know, one party or the other is likely to lose. So why don't we have that faculty? That's the question.
The point Matt made in his reply to this in Foreign Policy was that war tends to be negative sum, but I think he was fundamentally talking about modern war. I don't think he was necessarily talking about a hunter-gatherer society, although you can certainly imagine negative-sum encounters. It depends on how you do the calculating and so on.
I can't possibly imagine a positive-sum encounter. How does I club you over the head? How does that wind up being positive-sum?
How about this, okay? Let's just look at it from the male's point of view into, like, neighboring villages, okay? They each have 10 males.
Okay.
They go at each other. The winning side loses 2 males, okay, and the losing side, they kill 5 males and the rest flee into the woods, but meanwhile, all the females in the neighboring society are, like, abducted or whatever, and this is the way primitive war was conducted. You steal the women. Well, if you look at the reproductive success of the so-called winning team, they indeed won in Darwinian terms. You can get into these subtle individual selection and group selection arguments. I won't bore you with them. You can fit this into either kind of argument in theory, but that's an example of when it's not a net loss on the winning side.
Oh, it's not a net loss on the winning side, but it's a net loss overall because
when Matt says
the losing side loses just as much as the winning side wins. They've lost access to all those women. Plus, there's a net overall loss.
But natural selection wouldn't care about that. It's not an overall utility maximizer globally. If the question is why did something evolve, the question is you look at the genes of the people who you posit as having the trait. In other words, suppose this instinct arose in this one village, just to simplify the thought experiment.
Right.
Would it thrive or not? In the scenario I just gave you, yes, it would thrive. Because now the kids of 20 women are going to have it, rather than the kids of just 10 women.
But if the chances are equally good that they're going to lose the war, the instinct to start the war will not thrive, and in fact those people will be wiped out. I guess that's...
Okay, well now we're back to the original question. I mean, you would ask, isn't war kind of, you know... I mean, in other words, the alleged negative sumness, I'm saying, A, may or may not have applied in the ancestral environment, B, in certain incarnations, like the one that I outlined, would not have been a problem from evolution's point of view. Okay.
It's definitely not
in your interest to convince yourself that you're going to win a war that you're in fact going to lose, unless. Well, I'll forget the asterisk. Let's say that.
It is in your interest or it's not in your interest?
No, it's not in your interest normally.
Right, and that's right. So why
to convince yourself that you're going to initiate a war that you're going to lose? So right, and it may involve these cognitive biases, and I'm just saying the generic explanation. If they are adaptations, psychological adaptations that are misfiring, a very common explanation would be there's something different about the modern environment that is leading you to have more of these miscalculations than you normally would.
Well, why does it have to do with the cycle of serotonin, which is that if you think you're going to win, you're more likely to win? So your body, it's like every football coach says, we're going to go out there and win. So your mind convinces yourself.
To the extent that that is true, that could be one explanation. But, it's complicated because a lot of these adaptations could have arisen in intra-society strife, right? It's like, for example, men seem to become more confident that they're going to prevail in a fight if women are watching, It's like, I'm more likely to slink away, in abject submission. I mean, if I'm like a young male again and
right.
single, I'm more likely to slink away from a fight and humiliate myself if no women are watching. If women are watching, I'm more likely to try to put up some resistance, and the way I do that is actually convince myself that I may not lose. So that's an example where the actual explanation for the cognitive bias is, it has nothing to do with war per se or conflict between groups, yet you can imagine that kind of adaptation coming into play in a warlike, modern warlike setting, conceivably at least. So it's very complicated in that way.
Huh, it's all the women's fault. I knew it.
Speaking of women and speaking of this, maybe we should do a little particular incarnation of the question of how we got into the Iraq War by segueing to this Jeffrey and Jackie thing.
Yeah.
Jackie being a woman?
Jackie is a woman, yes.
These two are two arms control experts. They had this this little dialogue, you might call it. And one thing they did was they plugged into some stuff I had said to you and some stuff I had said to Andrew. I mean, first of all, Jeffrey got on Andrew's case a lot for not apologizing abjectly enough. I don't know what more you could ask of Andrew.
Well, there is one thing you could ask of Andrew.
Yeah.
He apologized to you, an opponent of the war, for supporting the war. Would he do the same thing to supporters of the war? Go to them and say, and he was saying, Bob, you are right. That's a sort of that's an apology, but it's also a suck up. Would he go to a supporter of the war and say, Bill Kristol, I was wrong to support you. You were wrong. You don't want to hear this, and would he do it just as forcefully? That's the question. He should be required to go through all the stations of the cross apologizing, not just to the people who are going to agree with him for apologizing.
Well, but it's not like he could conceal these things that are now on the public record. I mean,
well, because everybody watches Blogging Heads TV, but,
No, but I just mean it's out there. It's like things in his,
it's out there because Ariana put it on her site, but it does seem to me that there's an instinct to pander, and that was an apology that also involved his instinct to pander. Let's see an apology
okay, you want more from Andrew. Jeffrey wants more from Andrew. Anyway, two things. One is that Jeffrey alluded to this thing, which is really true, and if we're going to go back and reconstruct how we got into this mess of a war, this is one of the things we have to confront, which is that he was saying, before the war, when he was being skeptical of whether there were really weapons of mass destruction worth worrying about in Iraq, it wasn't just that people disagreed and they would say, well, okay, let's agree to disagree. It's like, if you took that line, it was virtually the case that your patriotism was impugned or your sanity was impugned. And it really was that bad.
Well,
I remember thinking after Colin Powell's UN speech, I did a piece for Slate saying, well, my point was, look, even if we Americans believe that he's established that weapons of mass destruction are there, you got to remember, in the court of public opinion, this isn't going to necessarily hold a lot of water. Not everybody attaches that much credibility to Colin Powell. Now, of course, nobody does, including us. But at that point, we were still attaching it. And I remember thinking, as I was writing the piece, I started thinking, was it possible he's wrong? It was a really persuasive presentation. I thought, but if I went through and nitpicked, could I is there still some possibility that notwithstanding that evidence, there's just no chemical weapons in Iraq? And I remember, I think I basically thought, what's the point? If you said that, you would be expelled from the realm of discourse in America. And so I just said, you know, okay, fine. Any reasonable person would agree, you know. And I convinced myself of it. Yes, definitely. The weapon, and I proceeded from there to argue that war still wasn't a good idea. But that's the climate of opinion we were in, is that you were a crazy person if you said what we now know is the truth. Well, and we have to ask, for one thing, how did we get in that situation, right?
That's standard Bush administration procedure. If you question his immigration plan, people like Fareed Zakaria and other respectable people claim you're a racist, nativist, Lou Dobbs type, and you're beyond the pale.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that that was what the administration would say about you. It was that, you know, many, many liberals would agree. You know, if you want to go back and look at the liberals and liberal periodicals who were part of this and helped foster this climate of opinion, then you would be feeling even more vengeful than I feel right now, because I'm not gonna name names. But the fact is, it was more or less the whole country. Well, it wasn't as bad as it had been right after 9/11, but it was bad.
Look at what happened to that UN inspector, who was Scott. What was his
yeah.
name?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, that's interesting because Jackie Shire, I'm talking to you. She is, you know, now Jackie and Jeffrey both are acting like they had things 100% right. What happened with the rest of us? And I'm pretty sure I recall talking to Jackie. I walked up, you know, and said, what's with this Scott Ritter nut? Asserting confidently that there are no WMDs in Iraq. And I think she proceeded to explain to me what his whole psychological framework was at the time, rather than say, well, maybe he's right, I think. But anyway.
I went through that exercise, too. Democrats were you know, eager to prove that they were realists and weren't naive. So we condemn.
You're right, exactly. No, there is that. You always are challenged to prove that you have a spine if you're like a liberal. And then there were a lot of liberal hawks who, beyond that, very forcefully supported the war. And as a result, you couldn't kind of talk this way. There's one more Jackie Jeffrey point that's related to this, which is just in terms of isolating a specific link in what I think was the cognitive failure of the nation before the Iraq War, and it's this. You know, I had been going on this thing. You know, I heard this Hans Blix interview like months ago where, and I think I talked to both you and Andrew about this, where he said, you know, he basically implied that, look, before the war, we had gone down the list provided by the CIA itself
right.
and looked in place after place. They just weren't there. And I said, wait a second, I never thought about it like that before. I mean, if Bush knew that this was the exact CIA list, then didn't he know that our intelligence had been discredited, right?
Right.
And Jackie, in this dialogue, kind of laughs at me for being so naive as to think anything else could have been the case.
Okay.
And in retrospect, on the one hand, she's right. You know, of course the targets were being given to the UN by Western intelligence services, and maybe it was explicit and on the record that it was the CIA, it was American intelligence that was doing it. But if that's the case, then the failure in the cognitive process is that at some point, you know, if it was that easy to figure out, and I guess it was, and it may have been explicitly on the record, but at some point there should have been the front page Washington Post or New York Times story spelling out the implications of the failure of the UN inspectors to find anything, which was, this cast serious doubt on America's intelligence, right? I don't think that piece ever showed up.
Well, but, I guess being laughed at by a woman triggers some Darwinian impulses, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm upset. I mean...
Yeah, but wasn't Jackie's point that it was the same as my point, which is it could just mean that our intelligence was right, but that their decision cycle was faster than us, and they got the weapons out of there before our inspectors arrived.
You know, I think with a lot of these, that's actually not too damn plausible. I mean, it's one thing with biological weapons per se, but if you're talking chemical weapons, which you have in huge quantities, and it's hard to eliminate all traces, and certainly, let's face it, the main concern should have been infrastructure for developing nuclear weapons. You know, that's kind of hard to stick in the closet. In any event, I mean, The piece should have appeared. There was enough that the piece I'm describing should have appeared. And there's something in the interaction between kind of journalists and people like Jackie and Jeffrey, it just didn't happen. There's some kind of synergy that should have happened.
It probably did appear, but I think it appeared in Newsday and not the front page of the New York Times.
Well, then that's a failure. But and you know who Hal Raines was editor of the Lefty Hal Raines, yeah. Right?
No, it was Lefty Hal Raines, but who was championing the reporting of Judy Miller? So,
well, that's another story.
It's complicated.
Okay.
But a good point.
I guess. You think it's just my venom toward Jackie for laughing at me?
I think so, but there are no women watching this, so we can all slink away.
You think we cleared them all out of the room long ago, dialogues ago?
I think it's like my blog. No women read it, so it's just us guys here.
Huh. I guess we need more eye candy. I'm recruiting younger males for exactly that purpose, you know. We had a couple like young males on last dialogue.
You are eye candy, Bob. You have a full head of hair.
That's all it takes.
You know? What can I say? I'm intensely jealous. That's my motivation here. So, do we have anything to say about Somalia? That's next on the list.
Yeah, we do.
We're saying that it's not as clear-cut a victory as we thought, that war is erupting on the streets.
We thought?
When
we last left Somalia, I was saying, I guess it's okay that the Islamists have been vanquished, but... A, if we don't restore, if order isn't restored quickly, there's going to be this ongoing guerrilla war. And B, to the extent that America is identified with, say, the Ethiopians, who very briefly restored order, and it's already started falling apart, to the extent that Americans are identified as the enemy, could well become another one of these global jihadist recruiting grounds. Well, the news since we last talked, Mickey, is there was this... American strike. America has now entered the war, basically. America is now our forces. We're not just training the Ethiopians and getting weapons. We're now killing people. We did this strike hoping to get, and it looks like we may have gotten a key player in the 1998 embassy bombings in Africa, who an Al-Qaeda guy, I guess. But... Again, question becomes, is it worth it? In the first paragraph of New York Times, maybe it's not the first paragraph, but anyway, New York Times piece today about the residue of the strike. Several residents of the area said dozens of civilians had been killed, and news of the attack immediately set off new waves of anti-American anger in Mogadishu, Somalia's battle-scarred capital, where the United States has a complicated legacy. And he quotes this guy who's a Somali taxi driver. They're just trying to get revenge for what we did to them in 1993. I thought it was 98. Was I wrong? Anyway.
You're wrong. It was the last year of the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I think it's 98.
I'm sorry, the first, it was, sorry.
Anyway, the, so let me just use that to revisit that point about following our evolutionary impulses, you know. The retributive instinct. I mean, I think this guy's basically right. I think Bush... I mean, I hope these were truly high-value targets in the sense that they're crucial to ongoing Al-Qaeda operations or something.
Well, what's crucial? If there is an Al-Qaeda training camp anywhere in the world, I think isn't it pretty uncontroversial that we would go and bomb it?
No, not if it leads to more recruits than... Not if the net effect is to strengthen the jihadist movement, no. And that's the question that the Bush administration, I think, still doesn't appreciate. Look, and you know... On this issue of, you know, we've been wondering, and they quote it, Mickey, they quote a guy who, a Somali in the parliament, I guess, who personally encountered two jihadists who were foreign. One had come from Sweden, one had come from Jordan, and I'm saying, you know, to the extent that this becomes another incubator for jihadists, it could be not in our interest to kill the guy who was responsible for some attack 8 years ago.
Bob, it's hard, if that's your grounds, it's hard, if you can't even attack a Al-Qaeda training camp in southern Somalia, when under your theory, will it ever pay to attack an Al-Qaeda training camp? There will always be people killed, so you're basically, it's like you and Osama bin Laden, there are no circumstances under which... except in clinical laboratory conditions where you could only take out Osama bin Laden or only kill Al-Qaeda terrorists in the training camp, where you would ever approve an attack on Al-Qaeda training camps. That's fine. Maybe that's your position. But you shouldn't pretend that you would ever attack them, because you're never going to attack them. You're always going to be worried about the blowback and the encouraging of more jihadists. And it seems to me there are many more cases than you let on when, in fact, the balance is in favor of attacking.
Perhaps okay, wait. First of all, I have not said this was definitely a bad idea. I said I hope these guys were indeed legitimately high-value guys, crucial to ongoing important al-Qaeda operations. To the extent that that's true, the case for doing what we did is strengthened. Okay? But I'm just saying that is the calculus to focus on. You know, does it do more harm by recruiting new jihadists? And there's real evidence that here we did cross a threshold that makes this a much more valuable recruiting banner for jihadists, the Somalian, you know, milieu, than it was before. Now, if you ask for, I mean, let me just briefly revisit this evolutionary thing. The retributive impulse, and I don't just mean the flash of anger that gets you to hit somebody back who hit you, but I mean the whole moral intuition that a good has been served, that justice has been done,
right,
when somebody who's done something bad gets punished, that evolved for a reason. And the reason is that actually retribution works sometimes, okay?
Right.
It's because it discourages, you know, somebody steals something from you, you hit them, they don't steal anymore.
Right, so why doesn't it work for us?
Sometimes it works, Mickey, and let me give you an idea when it would have, okay? Right after the Afghanistan war, if we had killed Osama bin Laden, seems to me probably that would be worth it. Because, first of all, the connection between what he had done and the punishment was very short-term, okay? He does the World Trade Center, we kill him, that's very short-term negative reinforcement. One difference is, these guys did something 8 years ago, you know, are potential jihadists going to go, whoa, there's a chance they'll get you 8 years after you do something? I don't know, I'm just saying, in terms of the negative reinforcement, it's not as valuable. What they had done to us was on a much larger scale, okay? We had the attention of the world still focused on it, so there were real differences. All I'm saying is that
the
we should always...
on a pretty large scale.
What's that?
The bombing of the embassies was on a pretty large scale.
Well, a couple of hundred people were killed as opposed to like 3,000 in 9/11. Yeah. All I'm saying is... It's completely clear to you that America crossing that bridge and joining the war in Somalia, we're now involved in three wars, that was a good idea. You sure of that?
No, I'm not sure, but I think you always seem to say, oh, everything is a bad idea. So now I've rested the concession that you're in fact straddling the fence and it might be a good idea.
No, I don't profess to be omniscient. I think, but if there's a reason that I stress this side, one reason is that clearly the people running American policy don't pay too much attention to it. They're paying more attention to it because of the fiasco in Iraq. But you got to admit, Mickey, I was saying it before Iraq about Iraq, right? I was saying that about the coming war in Iraq.
I don't know if this is
the downside that nobody's paying attention to. They're not gonna want us to be there after 2 years. To the extent that we recruit more terrorists than we kill, it's bad.
You're saying that they're starting a war in Somalia to distract from the failure in Iraq? That's possible.
Mickey, hold it. Just no point in continuing. I didn't say anything remotely like that. I didn't mean to say anything remotely like that.
I thought you were saying that is an interesting point. It's possible.
Yeah, I'm not that cynical. No, I think if there's a political calculation, it's that the American people will love to hear that there has been payback for that embassy bombing, and that's a case where I'm saying, there is this evolutionary impulse that will be gratified.
I think we thought we were losing Somalia to al-Qaeda, and this was our response, and they figured that this is better than losing Somalia to al-Qaeda.
An interesting op-ed in the New York Times on this by the only person I've seen emerge, you know, when these things happen, suddenly an expert emerges who's known all about this all along. The one guy I've seen who has shown up in both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times op-ed page as an expert on Somalia is a professor at the Naval War College. He seems to think that what we're doing is kind of misguided, and that the only hope lies in some kind of negotiation involving both the transitional government and the Islamic courts, which actually sounds like a tall order to me. I'm not sure that would work, but anyway, we'll link to that.
What, so we let the Islamic courts live in peace and have their little area where they can train terrorists to attack us, as opposed to having to fight a war against the transitional government?
Well, no, there's a couple things you could do. You could try to find an alternative means of establishing order through some major multilateral intervention. This guy argues that, that almost all forms of that are actually doomed. The fallback position is that what you would have done, say, a few weeks ago, you might have said, okay, you're the government, but we're going to hold you responsible in X, Y, and Z ways and try to use the levers of international relations to hold them accountable. It might work, it might not, but my point is, the question is always, you know, compared to what? Is that bad, letting them remain in power? Yes, it is bad, but the question is always compared to what? Was it bad to leave Saddam Hussein in power? Yes, but the question is compared to what? And this administration, I'm just saying, doesn't often ask itself compared to what?
I believe that leaving the Taliban in power in Afghanistan turned out not to be such a good thing. I'm sure we tried to wrest whatever concessions and set, you know, say you can stay in power, just don't let Al-Qaeda run rampant, and we didn't have enough leverage.
That's true. It's not clear to me that there was that was inevitable. I think there are signs that there was actually ambivalence among the Taliban about Osama bin Laden. In fact, there's actual evidence that there were...
Well, but if there were ambivalence and we couldn't pull it off, that makes it even a less plausible strategy.
There was what?
If the Taliban was ambivalent in Al-Qaeda and we couldn't coerce them into stopping Al-Qaeda, that means the strategy of letting them stay in power and trying to make them coerce Al-Qaeda is even less plausible, because even when they want to do it, they can't do it.
Well, it also means it could have in principle gone either way, and he might have actually gotten, you know, booted out of the country 6 months earlier. There's also the fact that right after 9/11, there turns out to have been a lot of sentiment among Taliban and among jihadists everywhere that Osama bin Laden had screwed up. And if we had handled things well and not invaded Iraq, that might still be the consensus. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about cars.
Let's talk about a series of things that you want to talk about more than I do, because I've talked too much, and cars is certainly one of those things.
You always talk too much. You're like Charlie Rose. I'm joking. I'm joking, Bob.
You mean that in a good way, right?
No, one of them is one thing I want to talk about, which is it's the auto show in the big auto show in Detroit. It's the biggest show of the year. And the biggest story out of it seems to be that Toyota isn't pulling its punches. They're being very aggressive. And the political resentment that there was to this move about 5 years ago, it doesn't exist. They have enough employees in America. They're doing enough business in enough local communities that if they kick Ford's ass and kick GM's ass, Congress is not about to intervene to stop them, and they're not even worried about Congress intervening to stop them anymore.
They're not?
They don't seem to be worried.
Isn't there a new kind of protectionist impulse surfacing?
But it's not against Toyota, and they build the cars here. What are we going to do? 90% of the Toyota Santa minivan is sourced in America. What are you going to say? You're a Japanese-owned company. You can't do business in America. We're going to protect the American car companies that the consumers don't want to buy the products of?
So a majority of all Toyotas sold in America are now made in America?
But there are enough of them so that it's that argument is very muddy. That's the point.
Okay.
And the standard reaction of liberals, like many of my friends, is to say, look, the problem isn't the UAW and union workers, because American cars are as reliable as Japanese cars now, which is sort of half true, 60% true. It's the designers' fault. It's because their designers are better than our designers. It's not the UAW's fault. The fact that all the UAW companies are failing and all the non-UAW companies are succeeding, that's irrelevant. And the classic example was comrade Bob Kuttner in the Boston Globe.
Now, Mickey, comrade is kind of a loaded word here, isn't it?
Well, we used to call him Comrade Kuttner at the New Republic.
And right? What did that mean? I didn't call him that, but what did you mean when you said it?
I mean he's a lefty with a Stalinist mentality to stamp out people in his own publication who disagree with him.
Just wanted to get that on the table.
Ask Anna Marie Cox. But and I'm mocking him in a lighthearted way. He drove a Pontiac G6, which is an incredibly disappointing car, and he came to this conclusion and said, you know, it's GM's designers and it's the fault. It's not the union's fault because It's not poor American workmanship or the cost of American labor, because Japanese total labor costs are comparable, even with Detroit's higher health insurance costs. Well, like many things, Kuttner says, this isn't true. First, GM's labor costs are higher. If you look at this, an NPR fact sheet that I will link to, GM pays $31.35 an hour, Toyota pays $27 an hour, a non-trivial difference. But the big thing is because in part of silly work rules imposed by UAW locals, it takes Toyota less than 28 hours to produce a car, and it takes General Motors 34 hours. And if you add those two things together, the extra cost GM has to pay to its unionized workers and the extra time it takes GM to make a car, it turns out GM's paying 43% more for its labor. And how is it going to compete paying 43% more? Answer, it's going to cheapen the materials and the stuff that goes into the car. So if you look at a Ford 500, it's a nice car. It's based on a Volvo, but the interior is incredibly flimsy because they've tried to make up for the extra costs of the unionized workforce by skimping on the interior materials. And all, you know, if you read the car magazines, there are all sorts of Detroit designers who say, we design perfectly good cars, and then the cost cutters come through and they destroy them by cheapening them. Why did they destroy them? Because they're paying too much for the unionized, inefficient workforce. So I submit that, contrary to Comrade Kuttner, it is the UAW's fault, and just because American cars are now reliable does not mean that it's not the UAW's fault. End of rant.
Well, I wish I knew enough to argue with you. I think some defender of labor unions should be pitted against you. I don't know enough about any of this. But the are you against labor unions generally? You just think they're bad?
I think they work in some sort of circumstances where you really need a countervailing power, like coal mining. But I think in general they're an obsolete model, and because they gum up the works, you know. In the 1940s, you didn't need industries that reacted fast. We were in the era of plotting mass production. Now we need industries that react fast, can reassign people, and this model where every decision is the product of a headbutting between union and management, that doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anywhere in the world. It's ill-suited to the conditions of modern production, and you don't win a competitive contest if you have this sort of archaic institutional Wagner Act structure. So I think it's obsolete in most areas, and it's fading in the private sector workforce. I mean, it's only like 8 or 9% of the, maybe less than 8% of the private sector workforce is unionized. It's only thriving in the government sector. And in the government sector, it makes no sense at all because we don't want to give unions the power to bring the government to its knees and extract whatever wage concessions you can get by doing that. In L.A.,
How often do unions... Oh, you mean like the local level?
In L.A., the traffic engineers went on strike by jiggering the stoplights and tying up traffic at four key intersections.
What a great idea.
Well, why should they get paid whatever amount they can extort by threatening to bring the city to its knees?
What a creative idea. Shouldn't they be consultants for Fortune 500 companies instead of traffic engineers?
They were actually arrested. And they're about to go...
The flaw in their business plan.
Well, they were caught.
One stat caught my attention in that table of comparative costs that you alerted me to, and it was health care costs per vehicle. And I guess this was GM versus Toyota.
Yeah.
$1,500 for GM per vehicle, $200 for Toyota. That's huge. I mean, isn't that... Now, I mean, this is tricky because was this Toyota factories in the U.S.?
Well, yeah, because they have a much younger workforce. They have lower health care costs. GM has all these old codgers who are just waiting out to retire. And I think they have a more luxurious health care plan.
I'll bet that's part of it, that they get better health care. It seemed to me maybe
no deductible plan for a while.
Seemed to me an argument, you know, the argument we've heard before, which is that for the sake of the competitiveness of American industry, you know, we need government-provided health insurance.
I'm all for that, and Detroit is all for that, and GM is all for nationalizing health care to take this burden. But that 43% greater labor costs I had was before health care.
Yeah.
Okay, it didn't even involve health care. It's just the cost of union inefficiency and the greater, the greater wage concessions. And we now have this situation where every wage concession Detroit gets is going to be grudging and just enough to let it survive. So we're in a situation where there's no way Detroit is ever going to have a huge home run that just drives Toyota from the marketplace, because the union doesn't care about that. The union will just give Detroit enough concessions to preserve their own jobs, not to actually win. It's like committing enough troops not to lose a war, but not to win a war. And that's
okay.
The situation Detroit's in, thanks to the unions, or thanks to the union system. I don't blame, the unions aren't evil people. In fact, the UAW is the most enlightened union, but the whole system doesn't work.
Now, there's a newsflash. Mickey declares unions non-evil.
Thank you.
So while we're on the subject of consumer products, I guess I was going to just... I just have a question about this Apple iPhone thing.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone... the consensus seems to be this is going to be the next rage, right?
I guess, as a friend of mine said, the idea that I won't buy the next heavily hyped Apple product is unthinkable to me.
But wait a second. I mean, two quick things. First of all, Ezra Klein made the point, and he was he debuted with us, and I thought, you haven't had a chance to see his thing with Will Wilkinson, right?
No, I haven't. I didn't even know he'd been on.
Good opening witty repartee. That's as much as I've had time to look at. But what more do you ask for?
Not much more. Sex appeal.
Well, they're younger than we are, buddy. If anything is going to bring the women in,
does he have hair?
It ain't you and me.
Does he have hair?
I think they both have hair, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't think it's the color of the side of my head.
Okay.
He made the point, Ezra made the point on his blog, first of all, an exclusive contract with Singular means that all the people locked into phone contracts with other carriers can't buy it right away.
Good point.
That seems kind of problematic. The thing that stuck out at me, and this was alluded to in David Pogue's review in the New York Times, and he's really, really... Do you read David Pogue's technology column?
No.
They're always really acute, and he's extremely entertaining. He's really good.
Yeah.
And he is the only person I've seen who even made this point, but it seems to me he makes much too little of it, which is that as an email device, it doesn't have a dedicated keyboard. The whole thing is pretty much consumed by a high-resolution video screen, and so the keys appear on that. But that means that you don't have what you get on this Trio 650, which is tactile feedback. When you're going to have a keyboard this tiny, and the Apple's isn't much bigger than this, the tactile feedback is essential. You got to know you've hit the key. And it just seems to me, right now, most people paying a whole lot of money for a cell phone really want the... It's either a BlackBerry or a Trio or something. They really... Or a growing list of these kinds of things.
The
they really want
Blackjack.
That. What's that?
I hear good things about the Samsung Blackjack.
And that's got a dedicated keyboard,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to do much email, you have to. It just seems to me more and more people are going to be doing email, so I'm kind of puzzled. Fascinating.
I just thought it wasn't as good looking as I expected. I thought it just seemed a little Bed Bath and Beyond-ish to me. It has this little border, and it's got a square thing. It's going for the mainstream as opposed to the Danish...
Aesthetic. I think there's Danish considerations. For example, there's only one physical button on it. The rest of it is all done through the screen is touch sensitive, and the rest of it is done through that. And I've got to say, I went to the Apple site and looked at a preview, and the interface does seem kind of masterful functionally.
Huh.
But I suspect that only having one actual physical button is a sacrifice of functionality to style, to Danish elegance.
Well, I just bought a new Dell computer, and it is so damn ugly.
Well, Dell has always led the league in ugliness, man.
I'm just profoundly
those
depressed.
Guys. Whoa.
Sorry?
No, they produce a lot of ugly products and laptops.
But this was built on the web as attractive, and it's just not. Anyway, it depresses me every time I look at it. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it'll work.
You should be depressed. Now, do we have time? You wanted to talk about, right-wing candidates or something?
I was talking with some Republican friends of mine, and they came to the conclusion that everybody else is coming to the conclusion, which is that the standard movement right-wing Republicans who revere Ronald Reagan have no candidate in this race. The leading candidates are McCain, who's a maverick, Giuliani, who's liberal on social issues, and Romney, who is unreliable on social issues, who they don't have faith in. And, you know, as Dick Morris says, the only candidate, and I think Romney makes this joke too, the only candidate who doesn't have multiple wives in this race is the Mormon. If you rule out Romney, it's not clear who else there is for these people. Is it Mike Huckabee? Is it Sam Brownback? That, if you go that way, it's at war with the standard, the Republican tendency not to promote somebody who nobody's ever heard of, like Jimmy Carter. But, you know, the Republicans are very orderly. They usually nominate the guy who's next in line. The candidate who comes out best in the sort of, is he a real conservative and is he next in line, is, I'm afraid, Newt Gingrich. He's the only one who Dick Morris, in that article I sent you and will link to, the only one he can't trash. The problems with Gingrich are the problems everybody knows about, which is that he's an infantile egomaniac. But he's pretty conservative, and he's smart, and it just seems to me that the upshot of this hunt for the new Reagan is that Gingrich is in a lot better shape than we think.
But the religious right does not like him, right?
They just don't like him because of his personal sin.
No, but I think he's also assertive on issues like creationism, right? He doesn't dodge those issues the way Bush does.
I didn't know that, so.
I think that's true, because I think he has this self-conception of himself as this product of the Enlightenment, this highly rational machine.
Yeah. It's possible. Certainly the conservatives that I talked to were not enthusiastic about it.
He's a problematic figure, and he ultimately has a little of the Joe Biden in him in that he just talks too much. Yeah. I don't think he's not as bad as Biden, maybe, but it's a problem.
No, his problems are sort of eccentric and sui generis. They're not ideological problems. They're character problems. I was sort of hoping that the mainstream conservative ideology would collapse and fall apart and fragment. You know, there's several fissure lines. There's the immigration fissure between the pro-business, you know, more immigrants and the social conservative, let's worry about immigrants. And there's the small government, big government fissure, which is that Bush is basically a big government conservative. If you really believe in limiting the government, you're on the outs with him. But if you really believe in getting elected, as Governor Schwarzenegger shows, we want to expand government to cover health care. So there's a potential fissure along those lines.
On the issue of a conservative crack-up, do you think it's too much to hope and to see signs that the word conservative is starting to suffer the fate that the word liberal did a couple decades ago? I don't know when it was exactly that liberals started running away from the L word. Have you thought about this? Do you want to hear my array of data?
That's interesting.
Well, okay, two things. I mean, I first started thinking of this, actually, when Glenn Reynolds was on, and he said, well, I'm not really so much of a conservative. Now, people tell me that he has actually been saying that for some time.
He's been saying that for a long time.
Okay, yeah. But Ann Althaus, also on Blogging Heads, has said that, and something like that, like she shouldn't be pigeonholed as conservative. And that has surprised some people, including a conservative I've talked to who's familiar with her work. There's also the fact that libertarians, you know, this libertarian piece that appeared in, did it originally appear in the New Republic? I think so, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you know the idea, right, that libertarians kind of approaching liberals and wanting to cut a new deal and saying, well, you know, why should we be especially associated with conservatives? We'd rather do a coalition with you. Now, a lot of liberals kind of gave them the back of their hand and said, no, you're not offering us a very good deal. And we've had some dialogues on that, like Mark Schmidt and John Chait talked about it. But it's interesting that some influential libertarians are not wanting to be associated with conservatives anymore.
I see that happening with with Bush, people distancing themselves from Bush, and I see that happening with the neocons, people distancing themselves from the neocons. I don't necessarily see that happening with conservatives, and in fact, conservatives are some of the people who are distancing themselves from Bush and the neocons. You know, a lot of conservatives are now very outspoken against the war. If you go to Powerline, Powerline's even against the surge, I think. And there are people like Heather McDonald and George Will who never much liked the war to begin with.
Right.
So I don't quite see that happening with the word conservative.
Yeah, and actually Andrew Sullivan is a case of trying to hang on to the word and distance himself from a lot of the actual conservatives.
Yeah. So I think the word is sort of has escaped. But people are definitely distancing themselves from the current Republican administration.
Well, yeah, and with good reason. And good reason.
But anyway, that's all I have to say. But the right wingers are in a genuine dilemma, and if we had more right wingers on, they could tell us where they're going.
Hey, well, you know, you should do. I keep saying, you know, it's your turn to do Glenn Reynolds. Oh wait, he claims he's not a right winger. I'm sorry, I forgot.
He wouldn't be good for this. He's not a mainstream Republican looking for. I mean, the other places.
Well, wait, but I don't get it. Wait a second. I mean, his politics are his foreign policy politics seem to me right wing.
Yeah,
fundamentally.
He's pro gun control.
And his libertarianism leads him to be skeptical of a lot of domestic regulation, right?
Right, but he's.
Okay, so where exactly is the non-conservative part? I realize that on the social issues.
He's pro-gay marriage. He's probably.
I understand that. I understand that, but aside from that.
Relatively tolerant of drug use.
Well, I realize this. On the social issues, the libertarian in him makes him not conservative in the sense in which a lot of conservatives are, but I don't get a major, major protest because it seems to me on all other fronts. Anyway.
Well, for example, I'm not sure he votes Republican most of the time. That would be a test.
Well, it could be a test. It could be a paradox. But anyway.
Well, the other dark horse here is Jeb Bush, but I don't think we want to go there.
I don't think the name Bush is going to be a real asset in the near future.
Unless he gets into like a real punching, he should have a big brawl with his brother. That would help him.
That would.
Okay, we've got an hour and 6 minutes.
Yeah, that's probably enough. New record was set yesterday.
It was?
Yeah, an hour and 10, but I mean, it's the younger generation. I say let them come on, take the stage.
Isn't the ultimate end state of blogging is that it's just going to be live around the clock and you know, somebody will
be... I feel up to it.
Somebody will be blabbing all hours of the day?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to have head-mounted video cameras so that you and I can just walk around doing our normal business, talking to each other on the phone, and it'll all be televised. And it'll always be you and me.
That's what I wanted. I didn't want you letting these other people.
I know.
Jesus.
I know you did. But I have, and it's become a global media juggernaut.
What can I say?
I don't know.
I'm not going to admit you were right. I think you've gotten yourself in a quagmire.
No, quite the contrary. There's momentum.
A surge.
There's a surge.
Okay. I await the results of this surge.
We'll talk about it more next week. We'll have details on the surge. There is a surge. There is a blogging head surge, and we'll have details on that in a coming show, probably next week, if you and I do it.
That's very exciting.
That is exciting. That'll get them on the edge of their seats.
It'll be like the announcement of the new iPod phone.
Kind of.
iPhone.
Except that I will not be among the naysayers.
You look sort of like Steve Jobs.
You think so?
You have the same sort of, you know.
The same stage presence.
The same stage presence, the same blue jean wearing sex appeal.
Yeah.
The same, calm, influenced by Eastern religions and meditation.
Yeah.
It's, I've never seen you in the same room with him. So.
Then I do have a secret, but I'm not going to talk about it now.
Okay.
You know whose brother he actually is?
Mona Simpson.
Yeah.
I knew that.
But they weren't, like, brought up together or something, right? Because he's adopted or something?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think there's some very complicated story.
I know they're brother and sister, and it was secret for a while, but...
I think maybe they didn't know for a while, but I don't know.
Okay, well...
We don't want to set a new the record that was set yesterday, so we should get off of here.
Cool.
Or even break the record. Okay.
Take care.
All right. See you.